Hello again and welcome to In the Studio. Redbeard here with the stories behind history's greatest rock songs.
You're welcome. Guitar up. One, two, three.
Today, In the Studio, it's the singer-songwriter, guitarist, and producer who's appeared on almost 50 million albums.
The only reason I ever went out and tried to make solo albums, because there were things there that politically were not possible within the band. And if that became the start of trying to define myself as an individual, but it was only by default. You know, if the band had all wanted the same thing for the same reasons, who knows what would have happened. Hi, this is Lindsey Buckingham in the studio for the best of Lindsey Buckingham.
When Lindsey Buckingham joined veteran British band Fleetwood Mac in 1975, the band had already released 10 studio albums, none of which had sold more than 300,000 copies. The first one with Lindsey Buckingham and musical partner Stevie Nicks sold 5 million. The second, 1977's Rumors, has sold to date 19 million copies, and that's in the U.S. alone. Now, from my experience interviewing musicians at the epicenter of phenomenal successes, such as Tom Scholz and the first Boston album, or John Bon Jovi with Slippery When Wet, or Metallica with the Black Album, it seems they all mark time by life before and since these life-altering events. And they spend the rest of their lives trying to understand exactly what happened to them, not unlike a person who has suffered a near-fatal accident, or attack, or disease. So it was perhaps no surprise that the record company, band management, and maybe even some band members would get drunk on the mega success of Fleetwood Mac's Rumours between 1977 and 1979. But no one could predict that the hangover would last into the 21st century, at least for Lindsey Buckingham, who, it appears, was the only pig not at the trough for doing Rumours 2, or Son of Rumours, or Bride of Rumourstein, as a follow-up. You sing, so that's been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling unheard.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that is profound. What a way to start an album.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's not beat around the bush. Let's just get right down to it.
Mm-hmm.
In the song Message in a Bottle,
mm-hmm.
Sting compared the act of writing as sending out an SOS.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been sending out creative distress signals up until now?
Creative design. Well, I don't know if I'd call it that. I think the reason that I could look at certain disappointments that have existed for a long time, certain frustrations that have existed for me for a long time, in a song like Not Too Late, and be so brutally honest about it, is because my life is in a place now where I can actually turn around and look back at it a little more and be a little more objective about it. In a way, it's only because I'm sort of past it. And that's because I met someone and got married, and I now have 3 kids.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And, I saw a lot of my friends who kind of were not there for their kids in the 70s and 80s and did what they thought they had to do, and a lot of the kids suffered. And I had such a great upbringing myself that I just swore I would never do that. And I had a lot of long-term relationships with women which were semi-dysfunctional, but, you know, that was my own problem too, and me working out my things. And suddenly you find yourself in this position at a point. I mean, I had my first child when I was like 47, So obviously your priorities shift, you know, you a whole other way of looking at the world opens up, and you can maybe look back at some of the things that have been concerns for years and years and say, well, okay, here I am talking about them, but maybe the irony is that they're not quite as important anymore. And you can really look at it a little bit, at what was, you know, perhaps slightly askew even in your own set of concerns, you know.
Yeah.
when you play electric six string, your right, your strumming or pick hand, if you will, looks like your fingers are flicking flies off of the strings.
Well,
you don't use a pick.
No, I don't use a pick. I taught myself to play, and the way I taught myself when I was, you know, about seven or so, was listening to my older brother's rock and roll records. And Scotty Moore, who was Elvis's guitar player, had a kind of a pick and finger style that I picked up on. And then later on, when the first wave of rock and roll started to kind of fall away, and Elvis went in the army, and there was a period of time when the singles got a little less interesting, I picked up on folk music as a replacement. And of course, folk music, one of the basics of folk music is what they call the Travis pick, which is just a rolling thumb and two finger pattern. And somehow I added a third finger into that myself. There was a period of time where I was sort of dabbling in bluegrass banjo, which probably relates a little bit, which I can still do, not very well, but just enough to get by. And all of that was the basis for, you know, somehow translating that to electric guitar. You know, I did not play lead guitar for years and years. Stevie Nicks and I were in a band after high school for about 4 years up in the Bay Area in California. And because I didn't play lead and because I didn't have the gear, I played bass. So it really wasn't until I was about 21 or so that I started picking up lead skills. And by then, my finger style was so well in place that it was a kind of a strange hybrid that began to develop out of that.
Your guitar chops are all self-taught?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't read music. I've never been able to read.
You don't read music?
No, never been able to read music, and not even charts. I don't even read chord charts. So I'm a lousy studio musician. I don't even know enough, really, you know, in terms of covering the gamut of what you might need to know for a particular song to be able to pick it up quickly. I just have my own thing that I do, you know, and you know, what can I say? I'm sort of a primitive who took that approach to a place where he could add some intelligence to it and some maturity, and just, you know, luckily I had kind of an ear for the record making aspect of it too. So, you know, just the two things together, I guess.
Which came first with Stevie Nicks, a musical relationship or a romantic one?
A musical, for sure. Well, yeah, I think I was 16. Actually, she showed up at the high school that I was going to, Menlo Atherton High School, up in on the peninsula in Atherton, and her dad, I guess, was moving around a lot. I think he moved once every 2 years. So she showed up in her senior year. I was a junior. And I didn't really know her too well. I met her. We were sort of vaguely aware of each other, vaguely aware that we both were musical and that she sang and sort of wrote songs or played guitar at least. And then she moved on and graduated and was going to a junior college up in San Mateo. And a year later, I graduated and ended up going to the same junior college. And over the summer, I had gotten in a band with some other people for the first time. My mom didn't necessarily encourage me to get in bands for whatever reason. Like I say, we were in a more a sporty kind of upper middle class kind of feel. I think she felt a little threatened that that was going to, well,
distract me from a proper career.
Yeah. Yes.
And what proper career were you pegged to be?
Well, I didn't really have one.
What did they want you to be?
They didn't really stipulate. I think she the most I can ever remember her saying was, "Well, if you want to do something artistic, you can always, you know, go into commercial art or something." But you know, not something where you have no net like rock and roll. And that's fair enough. I would never wish my own kids to do what I did, you know. We started rehearsing in my mom let us, my mom and dad let us rehearse in our garage, which we ended up doing for about 4 years. You know, my parents were saints. I swear to God, my poor dad coming home after work, you know, to this horrible acid rock music. Yeah, that wasn't horrible, but, you know, it wasn't.
It was to him.
It probably was to him, yeah. I did not get involved with Stevie romantically until that band had broken up and until somehow, because we had been singled out. We'd gone down and tried to get a deal in Los Angeles and were not successful, but somehow Stevie and I had been singled out as potentially being an interesting duo. So that fueled a fantasy for the two of us to go back up to Northern California. I had never written a song in my life. She was more experienced in writing. But so the two of us tried to develop a style with two-part harmonies, and I tried to start writing songs, and we ended up spending about a year working up there and just developing some repertoire on our own. And of course, during that time, we got romantically involved.
You may not be as strong as me. Keep up with me. I'll always be able to reach you. And if you go forward, I'll meet you there. And if you climb up through the cold freezing air, look down below you, search out above.
Love.
Hi, this is Lindsey Buckingham in the studio for the Best of Lindsey Buckingham. What we ended up doing was moving down to Los Angeles with Keith Olsen, who was trying to get us a deal. And now Keith Olsen would go on to, you know, be involved with the first Fleetwood Mac album, and would also be the guy who would make Fleetwood aware of me as a guitarist. But at the time, we didn't have a deal, and he was living in Studio City, and we moved into his spare room, and were there for a while, quite a while, and waiting to get a deal. Eventually, we sort of wore out our welcome and found a small place in North Hollywood. And we finally got a deal on Polydor, and we made that album. And of course, it didn't sell. Scrambled around for a while financially to figure out what to do. Started working on new material for a second album, even though we didn't have a deal. I got offered a job to go play guitar with Don Everly for just a few weeks. I think that was when Stevie went to Colorado. And Mick Fleetwood heard a song called Frozen Love off of the Buckingham Nicks album, and I think he was aware that Bob Welch was going to be leaving, and he was looking really just for a guitarist. He was not looking for another girl singer. And he asked me to join, and I said, well, if you take me, you got to take my girlfriend. So I guess he checked with Christine, and they figured, well, what the heck, you know, and that's what happened.
I myself personally start looking at you, this guy, Lindsey Buckingham, in the band Fleetwood Mac. I start taking you quite seriously as a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1975, I'm so afraid.
Well, that's the kind of thing that Mick responded to on the end of Frozen Love on the Buckingham Nicks album that probably made him think, oh, yeah, okay, Peter Green, a whole, you know, legacy of a certain kind of playing. And all of the songs of Stevie's and mine were basically demoed out very similarly to the way that they were cut. Not necessarily with any real effective rhythm section on them, but in terms of guitar parts and vocal arrangements. So that was one thing that helped the thing to fall into place quickly. I'd be so afraid that there's, again, that triad guitar that was, I mean, it was all there, you know. There was not a lot to do other than for John to start going, and for Mick to choose a kind of beat. And all those things were sort of in the group of songs that might have made it on another Buckingham Nicks album had we gotten that far.
What love is for.
Here's a quote. I'm an aberrant force in whatever surrounding I'm in, end quote. Did the hubris of 16 million rumor sales, or maybe an unlimited supply of cocaine, fuel that attitude back then?
Well, I wasn't a big drug user, but I don't know. I wasn't. There was nothing in me that was trying to be an aberrant force of any kind. I was only trying to, in some ways, since we had joined the band, I think, you know, everyone felt that I was sort of the musical leader of what was going on, and I was only trying to instill, not necessarily instill, because you can lead a horse to water, that's as far as you can go, but I was trying to lead the band into a place where we would be setting the stage for many, many future possibilities musically, rather than setting the stage for possibly us having to repeat a formula until it was dead. And, you know, again, that was if there was one thing that was, tragedy is too strong a word, but I mean, if there was one thing that to me was the saddest thing about Fleetwood Mac, from my perspective, it wasn't couples breaking up or any of that kind of stuff. It was just the fact that we weren't doing things for the same reasons and that we couldn't take the potential of what that album was and build on it. Because, you know, I think it really did keep us from growing as a band a lot more. And, the fact that we sort of, the politics dictated that we sort of go back to something more conservative. I think for a moment there, we had this really broad vista open to us musically that was, you know, completely valid, and it didn't matter whether it had sold in the manner rumors had sold. The group was a huge group nonetheless. It was just about having the world as your oyster and having the choice to make some provocative music and to build on that and to keep building on it. And we weren't able to do that, you know. And it is. That's a shame. I certainly never would have started making solo albums if somehow we had all been happy with Tusk as an outcome and had wanted to sort of move forward. But it just wasn't to be.
This world. I need the 411 on Under the Skin.
Well, all but two songs are relatively new, at least by my standards, you know, for someone who puts out solo albums, you know, on a not very regular basis.
You're on a circadian kind of release schedule.
Exactly.
Every 14 or 15 years, you come out?
Kind of the Terrence Malick of rock kind of idea. But, you know, it's something to be said for just doing something only when you think you want to, I guess, if you are in a position to be able to do that. Well, as I say, maybe all but two of the songs were for Under the Skin were written while I was on the road with Fleetwood Mac. And most of them were actually recorded on a very inexpensive Korg 16-track unit in the hotel rooms on days off.
Really?
And mixed, just to CD. Also in the room. There are two songs that predate that significantly. One is called Someone's Gotta Change Your Mind, and the other is called Down on Rodeo. And those two were done with Rob Cavallo and Mick Fleetwood. Could have been included on the last Fleetwood Mac album, Say You Will. They were mixed and ready to go even before that, but we just didn't, they didn't sort of get included. And I guess you could say that along with the material that ended up, much of the material that ended up on that Fleetwood Mac album of mine was once again intended to be a solo album at one time. So there's no one else on it.
Hear me, Annie.
when I the only reason I ever made a solo album to begin with, Law and Order, was because after Rumors, there were the axiom that it probably is more true now than it's ever been in the business, which is, you know, if it works, we're going to run it into the ground and move on. Was looming not only from the record company but within the band. You know, let's make Rumors too. Let's follow the formula. There were,
and they're always going to do that.
Yes, sure. And
because their business, it's a record business.
Yes, and I was, you know, attempting to make an album which would pull us out of that trap a little bit and would help us to evolve and set the stage for us to evolve as a band more. And that was the Tusk album. And it was only after it wasn't the making of the album. It was only when there was a sort of an edict that came down, not in the wake of the artistic outcome of that album, but in the wake of the commercial outcome, which was that it didn't sell 16 million albums. It sold like 3 or whatever. And it was a double album, you know. Nothing would have sold 16, but the point is I was put in a position to buy the rest of the band, saying we're not going to experiment like that anymore. We're not going to spread our wings creatively in those ways anymore. We're going to go back to the Rumors formula. And so that was the only reason I ever went out and tried to make solo albums, because there were things there that politically were not possible within the band. And if that became the start of trying to define myself as an individual, but it was only by default. You know, if the band had all wanted the same thing for the same reasons, who knows what would have happened.
Ooh!
Hi, this is Lindsey Buckingham in the studio for the Best of Lindsey Buckingham.
Do you think stardom can retard the normal maturation process?
Gee, you think? Well, sure. I mean, I probably even more so in the rock genre because, you know, rock and rollers are meant to be sort of, it's an extension of being a teenager. Although, you could probably argue how mature the Rat Pack was as well.
Good point.
But yeah, just in general, in a more general sense, absolutely. I think being an entertainer, being in a situation where, number one, you're having to sort of pull up a certain aspect of yourself over and over again to the point where it can become unnatural, you know, unless you are blessed with a certain gift or mentality and also have the political power to be able to make the right choices to kind of evolve yourself over a period of time. Some do and some don't. But you're being asked to define yourself in a fairly narrow way. You're being asked to allot your time in a disproportionate way. And people may not realize how much work it is to put a show together or to put an album together.
That's, you know, very clear.
And so,
and what about just the nature of the fact that your work is other people's play, other people's fun?
There's a kind of a gap there. It can be dead serious to you.
And, oh, it sure is.
And something else. And hopefully, one of the things that you can maintain is a certain distance or maybe lack of clarity about all of that. You know, you just, if you're looking at what you're doing and are grounded, being grounded is important. Grounded in your own process, grounded in what you care about, and the machinery will still get behind you, then you're going to be a lot better off. One of the problems that a lot of people run into, and we've all run into it at times, but some more than others. Luckily, since I haven't, you know, been stuck out on a limb like some people, or even Stevie, you know, she was. It's harder when people say, you know, you're out there by yourself, you know, on a certain scale. Then you can get into trouble of what of you in terms of your identity, how you think of yourself, because people think of you as something. People think of you as a false god or a real god. People think of you as something which is far elevated from a human level. And the machinery, unfortunately, tends to pander to that because it greases the whole idea of doing business.
It's a commerce.
And yeah, so, you know, people start to think of themselves in an unrealistic way. People tend to think of the world in a distorted way in terms of how it relates to them. And I think all of that can impede the idea of, I mean, we're all trying to become adults, and I haven't quite gotten there yet. I hope I never quite get there, but you know, striking a balance. But really, you see a lot of entertainers who just, and again, to be fair, in order to get through, to do what you have to do, you have to dredge up a certain level of selfishness, which probably is not appropriate, say, as a parent or as almost in any other situation. And you're being encouraged to be that because, again, it helps you to get to where you have to be to align with the machinery, with the business. So I don't know. A lot of people come in one side and never come out the other, you know. Some people have a hard time for a long time and somehow get it together. Some people come out, but they come out damaged. We've all been a little damaged, you know. I think of myself as being only sort of minimally damaged. But, you know, sometimes I wonder.
Things about to turn around. How
I think I gained possibly the space to just work and to try to regain some composure over a creative process for myself, which then became Out of the Cradle.
Great album.
All of that was what I had to gain. What did I lose? I probably lost a lot of income.
just being honest, right?
Yeah, sure. I lost touch with people that to some degree it's, but still, I feel that, you know, I lost a certain touch with a group of people that, for better or for worse, you know, I mean, these were people that were my best friends and my worst enemies all at once, you know, as groups tend to be, you know, for, depending on what day you're talking about, you know. But certainly people that I know as well or better than anyone I've ever known, except my family growing up, people that I've been through more with. And to some degree, I lost a little bit of touch with them, and you know, it's hard not to see them as my best friends in many ways still, and yet there's a distance that can be hard, because maybe it's me not being proactive about it. I know Mick is not that way, but you know, having pulled myself out of it, you know, I sort of have kept a kind of a distance. Maybe I just need to get to a point where I'm, you know, ready to give myself over fully. You know, we did a tour behind the album Say You Will. You know, Christine has moved to England, and it was the best tour that I ever been involved with for me. There was more space to get out and play and to be a guy. I mean, there was probably way too much testosterone on stage for Stevie, you know. So, you know, once again, we finished the tour. It was like, you know, a triumph for me. For her, I think it was less so. So how you find that middle ground is sort of I wouldn't say it's a mission, but it's an exercise that I wouldn't mind trying to get to, because, you know, these are people that I love and would like to continue to work with and to have everything end up in the best possible place. So that's the only thing that sort of, I can't say it's been lost, but it certainly was put aside and is still in the process of being, you know, moved towards just by virtue of having left. And that was a hard thing for them. It was a very hard thing for them to lose me, I think. And maybe in some ways it was hard for me to lose them too. But it, at the time, you know, Stevie came to me like 3 or 4 years later, because she lasted about another year and then she left. And she said, you know, I should have left when you left.
Oh, my love, the sky is burning. So much left to do. Don't.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking so much Lindsey Buckingham. Special thanks to Robert Richards and Tony Dimitriotis at East End Management, Tommy Nast and Victor Caballero at Center Stage in Burbank, and most of all to Raymond McGlamory. Visit www.inthestudio.net for this and your other favorite interviews. In the Studio was written this edition by yours truly, Redbeard. Transcription by Jane Carpenter. Theme song by Andy Timmons. In the Studio was produced by Barbarossa Limited. Copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Be a part of the In the Studio network. www.inthestudio.net.